Hey, Royce. We are going to talk briefly about the King Philip's War tonight. I'm going to talk about that. That's probably one of the few Indian wars, but I will talk about the Indians, Moravian missions to the Indians, and a couple of other things like that. But I will talk about the King Philip's War because of the devastation that it brought, but also because of how they looked upon it as a sign of judgment upon their colony. So that it play, it's a very has an important religious aspect as well as the war itself.
I know that one took place. Yeah,
which I'm not going to talk. I'm not going to talk much about. I won't really talk about that. Sure. Yeah, I'll do that. Don't forget to get your papers back there. There are notes back there. So, and so I don't know if they have any more of the notes three because I have an addendum, but we started that last week and we're still working on that one. So, if somebody doesn't have notes three, maybe they can find them for you. I talk fast, right, Royce?
You do.
I used to tell people they got more for their money that way. When you talk fast, you get more for your money.
I do more of the text on the song
track. Good evening again. Glad that you're here. We're going to start because it's 2 minutes after. And again, Dr. Weirs is here, and I'm going to ask Pastor Phillips to come pray for us tonight. And we're going to start.
So we pray. Lord, we do thank you for your kindness and your love. We thank you for your word and all the truth that you find there. We just ask you to help us to learn and then you apply our heart to us and use that to work greatly. And for Christ.
Amen. Okay. Now, in just a second, before we start, I'm going to show you something that I have hinted at and talked about briefly, but I thought some of you might like to see what it really looks like. I've talked about the surplus, that garment that bothered the Puritans so much. That is what it looks like. That the white thing that goes over the black robe. And that was what caused them so much tension. Because the Church of England required them that they had to wear that, and for them, it was popish and Romanist to wear one of those. And the interesting thing about this is that when the colony of Massachusetts lost its charter as a proprietary colony and became a royal colony in the late 1680s, I think it's 88, after about almost 50 years of being on their own, the same ship that brought the news of their having their charter revoked and they were going to now become a royal colony brought a Church of England minister. And he carried two things specifically in his satchel, a surplice and a Book of Common Prayer. In other words, we're going to get these. This is what makes a real Anglican service when you wear one of those and you use a Book of Common Prayer. So this was the garment. The white thing. Now the black robe, black Geneva gown, all the ministers wore those, Baptist ministers, everybody wore a black Geneva gown. They weren't upset with the black Geneva gown. It was the white thing over the top that in their mind meant it was papist and Romanist. And that was their terms. And they didn't like it. So that's why they had a whole huge controversy in the 1570s rather, over whether they had to wear that thing, as they would refer to it as. So, okay. Now, we're picking up with English settlements, and this is where we're getting into the real meat of what's the background to American religious history as we know it. Because the English settlements will provide us with the background of the colonial settlements that will be the foundation for church life in America. And we really have it divided into three distinct groups. We have the southern settlements, which we will actually start with first because Virginia is the oldest settlement. We have the colonial New England, which has its own distinct flavor. And then we have the middle colonies, which have their own distinct flavor. By middle colonies, we're referring to New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. A little bit of Maryland. Maryland is kind of the oddball, but it fits more in with the middle colonies, but sort of also blends a little bit in with Virginia. And if your family, like my dear wife's is, comes from old colonial stock, which many of you might, you will find that you have ancestors that probably come from one or more of these colonies. And what you're going to discover is we have English settlers. We'll also have a lot of Scots and Scots-Irish settlers. And then we'll have German settlers, in particular in Pennsylvania. And most people whose family roots go back to old colonial stock are an interesting mixture of those three, with little dashes of French or Dutch or possibly a little Swedish, or Finnish, because there was a little small Swedish settlement that Sweden tried to get into its finger in the pie too, and it lasted for a few short years. We really won't talk much about it, with a few Welsh thrown in, and mostly in Pennsylvania. So if you have those in your background, you likely have old colonial ancestors who would have come up through one or more of these church traditions. Now, if you're like me, your family came over in the 19th century, and you have a totally different history. My family was from the Netherlands. They immigrated between 1855 and 1888, all to Northwest Indiana or just south of Chicago. One of my great-grandparents farmed literally at 127th and State. You can't farm at 127th and State anymore, but he did. He had a farm there. And they have a different history. If you have German or Swedish or Norwegian ancestry, you have a very different history. Many people in Iowa have that. And they come into an America that's a slightly different America religiously than colonial America. And we will have to see how that works in. If your family was, let's say, Irish or German Catholic, you didn't start coming over until the 1840s. And then, so you came into a very different setting. So what we're working on tonight are the background of these groups that are the old stock, as we call them, the old colonial stock. And we're going to start with Virginia. Virginia was a colony that was founded by, not as a religious colony, but it was founded by people who would establish the Church of England in that colony. Remember, we said established church meant it was an officially state-supported church. And all of the Protestant colonies that were early, and Virginia was founded by people with strong, more or less Puritan sort of background. Now, you might say, wait a minute, I thought the Puritans were opposed to the Church of England. Well, yes and no, remember. Remember, most of them said they never officially separated from the Church of England. They just wanted to purify the Church of England. And the Church of England that gets established in Virginia will not be all that different in many ways from what gets established among the Congregationalists in Massachusetts and Connecticut. The difference will be the intensity of the people who are there, because we're going to discover there was a whole lot of difference in the group of people that they recruited for one colony as opposed to the other. And so the Puritan flavor in its early days especially is found there. So let's talk about Virginia then. The first settlement, founded in 1607 on the James River, Jamestown, is the founding town. And it was started as a commercial venture. Now, right away there, you have to realize that that is going to play a heavy role. And you have to understand what's going on here, because the English were kind of Johnny-come-latelys to this colonial stuff. The Spanish had been doing this for over 100 years, the French for about 40 years. And you have to remember that while they raided a lot of Spanish ships, Francis Drake and Martin Frobisher and others raided a lot of got tons of Spanish gold and silver from all those ships coming back, England did not have any colonies. What they had were a few fishing outposts along the New England coast up into what is today Nova Scotia, and they had temporary fishing villages, but no colonies. They had a couple of failed attempts. Sir Walter Raleigh had a failed attempt in North Carolina. Disappeared. Nobody knows for sure what happened to this colony. But Virginia was founded in as a secular money-making proposition by the Virginia Company. They named it Virginia after the Virgin Queen. And the Virginia Company was founded to try to make money. But that doesn't mean that there wasn't a religious component behind it. They established the Church of England. They sent along a clergyman. They sent along prayer books. He would have his surplus with him because he was a good Church of England minister. And he was going to have worship services. The earliest legal codes of Virginia made attendance at Sunday services mandatory. Now, this is not a Puritan colony per se. This is just a commercial venture. But you had to go to church on Sunday or you broke the law. They included penalties against Sabbath breaking, adultery, and violation of the dress code if you dressed too immodestly. So that's a pretty strong sort of colony. They had some attempts in their back of their mind to convert the Native Americans, the Indians. They had a few minor successes, and the most notable one being famous Pocahontas, who did not marry in spite of what Disney said. John Smith, she married John Rolfe. She went back and visited England. The pictures we have of Pocahontas is this Indian maiden with her dark, swarthy complexion, dressed in a high-collared Elizabethan outfit with an Elizabethan female hat on her, and she looks very, very English, except for the fact that her coloration is not English. She was clearly a Native American. She didn't live very long after she married John Rolfe, but there was some attempt to try to reach out in ministry to the Native Americans. The real problem that the Virginia colony would have, and we will come back to talk about some more of this as we go along, but right now, just a couple of things that we are going to talk about on the Virginia colony are this. The Church of England is established, but the geography of Virginia would prove to have some really harmful effects to the attempt to try to establish a church. And combined with the dependence on tobacco growing, because the first people that came were mostly people who called themselves gentlemen, which means they didn't want to do any work. And they expected, they had servants back in England, and they expected the servants to do the work. They didn't send enough servants along. And so the gentlemen are over here, and they expected to come, some of them, and find just pieces of gold laying on the ground. And you can pick them up and fit them in your pockets, and you're instantly wealthy. Well, there wasn't gold laying on the ground. Maybe in some places in Spanish America, there were some places where they could get easily access to gold. They never did find any gold in Virginia. Instead, after a few short years, for better or for worse, for much of American history, they discovered that the weed that people put in little pipes and smoke proved to be very profitable. Especially when Captain John Smith brought back some better tasting, apparently, Caribbean tobacco that was much better than the native Virginia tobacco. And they discovered they could make lots of money by having tobacco plantations up and down the James and the other Rappahannock and all the other rivers. But the fact that they developed up and down the rivers meant that once you got more than a couple of miles away from the rivers, you were in the woods and nobody lived there. Which meant that the parishes that they developed were sometimes 60 miles long. And it was expected that one minister was to minister to a 60-mile-long parish. Well, I don't care if you followed on a horseback along the path of the river or went in a boat up and down the river. You can imagine what it would be like to minister to a 60-mile-long parish. And it proved that many of the ministers found this incredibly difficult, which meant that a lot of people, you know, saw the minister two times a year, just enough for baptisms and burials or something like that. It's about the only time they saw him, which had a devastating effect on some of the spiritual life, combined with the lack of real zeal on the part of some of these gentlemen who are some of them now making hand over fist in tobacco growing. And discovered they liked horse racing, they preferred throwing dice and other things rather than having the minister come and bugging them, if you will. That's what they looked upon it as sometimes. So even though they had all these laws on the book, it meant that it tended to get a slow growth. It was also somewhat hampered by the fact that Until a few years later, about 1700 to be exact, almost 80 years later, some of the ministers that they recruited were not of the highest caliber. In other words, unlike the Puritan colonies where they got the eager beavers, you know, real fireball preachers who wanted to be there, sometimes what the Virginia Company got were the guy that maybe he tippled a little too much. Or maybe he played the ponies a lot and liked to bet on horses. And he got himself in trouble in England, so what do? Well, I hear there's a parish you can get, and they don't ask too many questions over in Virginia. So they got on a boat and came over. Well, you can imagine when you add all of those together, it's not exactly always the best. What will happen is, finally, what will save the Church of England, which is the established church in Virginia, is when the Anglicans develop a mission society called SPG, which stands for the Society of the Propagation of the Gospel. They recruited dedicated people, but you have to realize this is 80 years roughly after Virginia is already in motion. So it's really quite late before serious spiritual life gets going in Virginia, because they had all of these other factors coming against them. As we all know as well, there was another issue in 1619. A Dutch ship landed and debarked with a bunch of African slaves. And that would also play a factor, because while there were small numbers of slaves in virtually every English colony, Virginia, with its heavy emphasis on tobacco growing, which was hard, backbreaking work that depended on labor in a hotter climate than, say, New England, it was very quickly discovered that these gentlemen much preferred to buy African slaves and do their work. Then the question comes, what do you do with these African slaves? For a great long time, there was great reluctance to bring the Christian faith to them, because some of the gentlemen, as they call themselves, realized that if you baptized them, that put them in a level of equality with you that they didn't like. And so they hesitated. The SPG tried, but it would actually be quite a number of years later, into the 18th century, and even then it's rather sporadic. It's almost into the early 19th century before serious missions to African Americans were worked on. And there would be a series of a variety of churches that would do that. So all of these factors are coming into Virginia. Similar things, as we will see, will reproduce themselves in the Carolinas and Georgia, which also had an established Church of England. The other thing is that will come is in the back countries of all of those, you will find a whole bunch of other people who are not Church of England. Baptists and Methodists will actually arise out of the Church of England, but Baptists and Presbyterians will come into the back country, and they weren't official. And what do you do with them? Some people, like Francis McKimmy, as we will talk about later, got rather upset, especially after the Toleration Acts were passed in England, so that you didn't officially have to be a member of the Church of England, and they were restless under the Anglican establishment there. They had felt the free air of America. They were restless. And so these things would cause tensions. There was also a little bit of a tension that most of the Presbyterians were Scots-Irish rather than English, and so there was that ethnic tension that came in there as well. So that's all we're going to say right now about Virginia. But this is just the first colony. The next colony we want to talk about is Plymouth. Now, this is one that if you're my age, roughly, or a little older, a little younger, you heard a lot about, because every year in grade school, you made turkey feathers, and you colored turkeys, and drew pictures of the pilgrims at Thanksgiving, and you know a bunch of things about the pilgrims. And that's who these people are at Plymouth Colony. The Pilgrims, in one sense, are a group that religiously and historically are rather insignificant other than for symbolic reasons. Their numbers were small. Eventually, they were absorbed by Massachusetts, and religiously they aren't that significant other than in this symbolic first group that was here. But let's just talk briefly about them. They were separatists. Now, remember, we talked about separatists last week. They were the people who were the Congregationalists who had said Church of England is bad. Separatists were likely Unlike most of the other Puritans who interpreted the Pope as the Antichrist, this was common. The Pope was the Antichrist. They were likely to say the Church of England and the Archbishop of Canterbury was the Antichrist. You know, they were sure it was a bad, bad, evil church. And many of them then fled and went to the Netherlands. And our famous Pilgrim Fathers, as we call them, did that. They had a congregation in Leiden in the Netherlands. Didn't ultimately like it there for a couple of reasons. First of all, their kids were starting to cease to be English and were speaking Dutch and were blending into the Dutch culture. But second of all, they thought the Dutch were rather worldly. That's true. They thought the Dutch were worldly, and they didn't think they were very devout. Even though they shared a common Reformed faith, they thought they were worldly. And they decided in 1620 that they would get some land and come to the New World. They got a charter from the Virginia Company, but got blown off course. Instead of landing in Virginia, they landed in Massachusetts. That's getting pretty blown off course if you know your geography. They landed on the famous Plymouth Rock, which wasn't a very good farming area or all sorts of other things. But this small group of them, and a significant portion died during the first winter, landed there and founded Plymouth Colony. In doing so, we know them famously for the first Thanksgiving. I'm going to show you in just a few minutes the actual writings that we know about the first Thanksgiving, which is precious little. We have two contemporary accounts of what really happened at the first Thanksgiving. But interestingly enough, when they came over, their minister didn't even immigrate right away. He intended to a year or two later, but he died before he could come over. So one of their elders read the services and read sermons for them. Half the people that came over weren't even members of the church. They were strangers, as they called them. Some of them, like Miles Standish, the little spunky little short guy with his blunderbuss gun, he was a stranger. They brought him along because he was a good shot. he was the guy that was going to help them if they ran into trouble. But this colony was founded. It had a tuck-and-go kind of existence until finally it was absorbed by Plymouth Colony, and it was something that, other than it being first and being separatist, and there, by the way, there was tension between sometimes for the first few years between them and the non-separating Puritans who came in large numbers to the rest of Massachusetts because they tussled over the separation issue. That was a big issue for them. William Bradford, who wrote A Plymouth Plantation, has documented their early life. But let me just show you what we know, by the way, about the first thing. Oh, I have to tell you one other thing. They were also, like most English Puritans, not fans of holidays that they described as papish and popish holidays. The first day they got off the boat was Christmas Day, and they purposely worked on Christmas Day, as if to say, we're not those popish people. We work on Christmas Day. That's a pagan holiday, not a Christian holiday. And so the American Christmas, by the way, is really a product of the late 19th century, mid to late 19th century. Most of the Puritans did not celebrate Christmas at all. But Thanksgiving, we know that they celebrate. This is the one of two statements that we have about that first Thanksgiving. Our harvest being gotten in, our governor sent form on a fowling, that would mean shooting birds, that we might after have in a special manner rejoice together after we had gathered the fruits of our labor. In one day killed as much fowl, and with a little help besides, served the company almost a week, in which time other recreations we exercised our arms, many of the Indians coming amongst us, and the rest of their greatest king, Massasoit, with some 90 men, whom for 3 days we entertained and feasted, and they went out and killed 5 deer, which they brought to the plantation and bestowed on our governor, on the captain and others, although it was be not always so plentiful as it was at this time with us, yet by the goodness of God we are so far from want that we often wish you partakers of our plenty. That is pretty much what we know about the first Thanksgiving. One thing you should notice is no turkeys in there. The other thing we should notice is that it doesn't tell you a date. We have no idea. It could have been from late September to November. Because Bradford didn't put any, or Winslow, neither one of them put a date on it. And All we know is that they had something like the English Harvest Festival, and they shot some deer, and they shot some birds. We don't know what kind of birds, and they had a three-day festival. Beyond that, we don't know too much other than this brief thing from William Bradford, which says that they gathered in their small harvest. I'll paraphrase here. They exercised. They got some cod and bass and other fish, so they had some fish. And it's, as the summer then there was no want, and now began to come a store of fowl as winter approached, of which this place did abound when they first came, but afterwards decreased by degrees. And besides waterfowl, there was a great stand of turkeys, of which they took many. But it doesn't say that they served turkeys at the festival. It just said that there were, and this, apparently the lady who popularized Thanksgiving saw the thing about turkeys and decided it had to have been turkeys. She was really taken with turkeys. I love turkey myself. But she was taken with turkeys, and so she published all these articles and insisted turkey was the main dish. And this is our one mention of turkey. This little, and these are the only two accounts that we have of the first Thanksgiving. We don't know if the Indians who came were it just says they came. Were they welcome? How much did they contribute? We know they contributed some deer. What were the relations between them? It's probably been embroidered by all sorts of people on this controversy, but that is as much as we know. Now, that's what we're going to do right now with Plymouth Plantation and the Pilgrims, because the main story is what Richard's going to get up for us on the next set of slides, is Puritan New England. The Pilgrim fathers were Puritans of a sort, a small little distinct type of Puritans, but what we're going to have in the rest of Massachusetts and Connecticut, spilling over into Massachusetts and Maine, is the main body. And these are the ones that are really significant. Okay, the question we might ask is, why was this most important? Because, first of all, the sheer numbers, 9,000 in the first year alone, emigrated from England and settled in a multiple number of villages spreading out from the first settlement in Boston, in Massachusetts and Connecticut. Now, you might be asking, why all of a sudden in 1630 did they decide that they were going to emigrate? Well, there are a few factors that we need to keep in mind here. Remember, there's been this tension going on for 70 years. 60 to 70 years with the Church of England. By this time, many of the hot Puritans, as they were sometimes called, who the Congregationalists were convinced that the Church of England was close to being non-redeemable. And many of them also believed that England was under divine judgment because the king, by this time, had appointed Archbishop Laud, remember I put his name on the board last week, L-A-U-D, who was pretty vigorously anti-Puritan. And the king's wishes were being carried out by Archbishop Laud, who was putting real pressure on them to conform to the Church of England, number one, in ways they didn't want to. Number two, his theology was strongly Arminian. And he had it in his mind that, unlike previous people, they suspected there was creeping Arminianism. He was blatantly so. And he was going to try to impose it upon the Church of England. And they didn't want anything to do with that. Here's another example. James I, Charles I was the king at this time, his father had published something called the Book of Sports. What was the Book of Sports? It was a book of things that you were supposed to do on Sunday. And it was to be read in the churches. Among the things, go shoot archery, go instead of dances on Sunday, and do all sorts of things. As you can imagine, from what we've learned about Puritan Sabbatarianism, who had a three-hour service in the morning and a three-hour service in the afternoon, this went over like the proverbial lead balloon. Charles had it republished and made them, by decree, read this from the pulpit. Well, these sorts of things were finally just gotten to them. and they decided it was time to emigrate. There were certain parts of England, particularly in what they call East Anglia, around Cambridge, and the eastern part of England, which was the Puritan hotbed, because Cambridge University was always the more Puritan of the two universities. Many of the ministers had trained at Cambridge. They had studied under the great Puritan theologians, such as William Perkins, the guy who did the bubbles that I showed you last week. He was the big theologian who was there for a number of years. And these ministers finally had decided, in consultation with a number of the squires, people like, remember I showed you the Cromwell scene. You know, Cromwell was the squire, the leading landowner in the area. Many of them were strong Puritans. It was compounded in addition when in 1630, Parliament was disbanded. The king disbanded Parliament, which did not meet for 10 years. It would be like our president disbanding the House of Representatives and said, I can rule without you. Well, the Puritans dominated the House of Commons. And to them, this was just further sign God's judgment was upon England. Now, 10 years later, they would have loggerheads because the king needed money to fight with the Scots because he tried to impose bishops on the Scots and they rebelled. Oh, Scots did not like bishops and they rebelled. And he needed money, so he had to open Parliament again, and they got matters got out of control. Eventually, they beheaded the king. And so, it really got powerful, and all sorts of issues. But between that time, 9,000 between 1630 and 1640, of the hottest of the Puritans, but still non-separating, they still said we were officially Church of England, emigrated to New England. Now, they included strong and dominant university-educated leaders, including ministers. Sometimes whole congregations emigrated. Not lock, stock, and barrel. The whole congregation would emigrate. And can you see the difference between this and what we saw in Virginia? They settled in little compact villages, and when you English style, they worked the farms outside of the village. And they built buildings. They didn't call them church buildings. They called them the meeting house because it would be the same place that you had church on Sunday, your town meetings on Tuesday night, and school Monday through Friday. And sometimes it just was a matter of flipping which side of the building you faced. The pulpit was on one side and the school teacher sat on the other. And they were very plain. They instituted their plain Puritan worship with their three-hour services, with the hour-and-a-half sermons, the long Bible readings, everything that they wanted to do in England, they were able to do in New England. They were highly educated as a whole. Virtually the whole population was literate. And many of them were people who were incredibly serious about their Christian faith, committed to the Puritan way. But this will become a crucial factor in the later history. This is picking up from what we said before. Remember, the Congregationalists were committed to the experienced conversion. So virtually all of those who emigrated to Massachusetts and Connecticut, Boston, New Haven, Hartford, all these Puritan towns, were committed to the idea that when they covenanted together in a local congregation, you had to the congregation, give testimony to an experienced conversion. Now, you need to understand what this experienced conversion was like. You just didn't go in and say, I trusted in Jesus when I was 10 years old. That would never cut it. You had to tell them that you had experienced the terrors of the law, that you had wrestled perhaps for weeks, maybe even months, under conviction of sin. And then you finally found assurance of grace in Christ. Otherwise, they didn't trust your conversion. That's a spurious, phony conversion. Anybody can say that, they said. I trusted in Christ when I was 10 years old. Anybody can say that. You had to explain that you had gone through this earth-shattering kind of conversion, which most of the people who emigrated had. Why? Because they had been weaned off of this in this nexus of East Anglian Puritanism, where the churches They had sought out those kind of churches purposely and had experienced themselves that kind of conversion. Now, the rub will come in just a few years. What do you do about the next generation? We're going to come back to that. But that will be the rub. By the way, there were a few of the Presbyterian and Anglican type of Puritans. Some of the Anglican Puritans did go to the southern colonies. Some of the Presbyterian type would go to East New Jersey, would be a place where some places on Long Island. They didn't tend to emphasize the very dramatic conversion. But the Congregationalists, almost to a man, there were only a handful of congregational churches, and they always were at odds with the others, that didn't require the experienced conversion. Their moral vision was extremely strenuous. I told you just a little while ago about the rules that they had in the Church of England in Virginia. Up the ante on that just a little bit more, and you have an idea what Massachusetts and Connecticut would be like. Church attendance was required, and you were there for both of those three-hour services, listening to all of the sermons. And it was expected that you were there, took part of this. By the way, in Massachusetts, not necessarily in Connecticut, they were a little looser in this, but Massachusetts, to vote in the government, you had to be a church member. So there was a lot riding on the issue of being a church member. And they tended to call it the New England Way. Now, sometimes people have said, is this a theocracy? And virtually every serious historian will tell you no. Ministers had no official rule over the colony. John Winthrop was the governor. He was a devout Puritan layman. He was the governor, though. He had been a landowner, a squire in England. All of the other political leaders were not ministers. So it was not technically a theocracy. But it did not mean that Puritan ministers didn't have a huge impact, because they were the ones, twice on Sunday, for an hour, an hour and a half apiece, were proclaiming the scriptures, who were setting forth the goals and aspirations of this colony. Many of them, as a matter of fact, the overwhelming majority, were post-millennial in their view of the second coming. You might say, what does that mean? They believed that the golden age was going to come after, Christ was going to come after the golden age. Some of them, and there actually been some historians who worked with this some, and probably worked with it not as well as they should, because other historians have said they didn't understand the theology very well behind this, who tried to say that's what drove them completely. That's a misunderstanding, but many of them, it was a side but important part of their thinking, that they were here and England was going down the tubes. They hoped New England would go up the tubes and maybe be the place where God would start the golden age. For example, John Cotton had a very interesting interpretation of Revelation 20. He believed the first resurrection, he was a key minister, the first resurrection was a resurrection of churches. The second resurrection was the second coming. So the first resurrection, if you had now developed pure churches, can you see the thinking? You've developed a pure church. We maybe are going to establish what will flow into the golden age of Orthodox Reformed Christianity with converted people filling the churches. It worked quite well, the system did, for most of the 17th century, but by 30 years after, it was starting to show some of its cracks, the system. And we will talk about the halfway covenant and one of the key cracks in just a minute. As I said, here are the colonies. Besides Massachusetts, you have New Haven and Connecticut. We have the emphasis on, these are just some of the things I was telling you earlier. But you might say, what percentage of them were church members? About half. About half the population. Can you imagine? Have you ever been around in a population where at least half the people would claim to be serious, not just nominal, but serious church members? And that's what the situation was. They stressed education. Look at the year when Harvard was founded. That's 6 years after they landed. They founded a college. And today, most people know that it is considered probably one of the premier institutions in our land educationally. They founded that. Why? They wanted an educated ministry and an educated people running the place. They passed a law for that you had to teach your children to read and write. And guess the name of it, I love it. It's called the Old Deluder Satan Act. In other words, that so that old deluder Satan won't confuse us as he did all those papists and Romanists. That's what they talked about in there. We all need to read and write. Why? So we can read the scriptures. Reading the scriptures was crucial for them. Cultural life did flourish. There was strictly religious poetry such as Ann Bradstreet and Edward Taylor. Sermons were printed galore. But the one thing that historians have discovered is that for all of the religious life, it doesn't mean that they stamped out non-Christian tendencies completely. There's a well-known historian wrote a book called Days of Wonder, Days of Judgment. And he's apparently a fine historian, taught at Brown, I think, for Brown University. But he discovered that one of the things that they had to try to deal with is that there was a black market in astrology books and other kinds of things going on, even in the midst of this Puritan colony, where half the people were church members, where everyone was in church for three-hour services twice on Sunday. They still had a black market in astrology books. There was still the wise woman, that was her term, you'd go to for your folk cures, and she was sort of like a gypsy folk healer or something like that. And so there was this undercurrent, and it's fascinating, is people have even traced that the rise, this is going down 200 years from now, the rise of Mormonism in the United States. Joseph Smith's family has a long family tree in that underground current of folk magic. So you can start figuring the connection. In other words, many of the people were serious Christians, but underneath it, there were still a few out in the fringes. And sometimes those people would move far, far away. They would sometimes try to move far away. They were the first into Vermont and northern New Hampshire. Why? Because I want to get away from those Puritan villages, you know, those kind of people. Sometimes they would come over as indentured servants and chafe under it. Majority of the population didn't, though. Here's what somebody has said. Most New Englanders would have heard over 7,000 sermons in their life, with the average length of 2 hours at each sermon if they lived a full life to 60 or 70 years. That's a lot of biblical teaching. What was a Puritan sermon like? There was a classic style, and it would go observations, and they would take their text, and they would do these observations. These would be just random observations that the minister saw in the text. He might give you some historical background. He might give you this and that. Then there was doctrines. And when Puritans said doctrines, why were the sermons 2 hours long? Because if it said Christ, they would sometimes give you a full Christology. If it said Trinity, they'd give you a full discussion of the Trinity. If it said death of Christ, you'd get a full doctrine of the atonement. Why? Because you had to expound the doctrine that was in the text. You know, and people would hear the doctrines expounded over and over again. But then classic Puritan sermon was uses, the practical application. The Puritans were very serious about application. They applied the text. They applied it deeply, dug deep, were not opposed to naming names almost if they needed to from the pulpit. They were going to apply the text. The sermons touched on every portion of life, but politics in the pulpit. So for a long time, people thought Puritans didn't talk about politics until they discovered a whole trove of sermons that were the election day sermons. You might say, what are those? Well, when you had an election day, before you went and voted, you had to go hear a sermon. You go to church and hear a sermon first. Can you imagine today? You have an election coming up, if you had to go to church and hear a sermon. They did. They heard an election day sermon before they would go to church or go to vote. And that's when the minister would talk about the political implications of what you're doing. So it touched on every portion of life. Now, touched on everything in society, but I've already mentioned that sometimes things weren't always as smooth. The halfway covenant, which was officially put into place in 1662, 32 years after the first Puritans landed, is the first sign that things were a little uneasy in Zion. what the halfway covenant was about. And let me just try to give you a set of two scenarios here so you can understand what the issue in the halfway covenant, because even a lot of historians, I think, don't always understand this. We talked about Puritan covenant theology and their doctrine of the covenant and the child being born into the church connected with the baptism of infants. Classic Presbyterian doctrine, I'm a Presbyterian, so I can hopefully help you explain this, is that children born into the covenant are not necessarily regenerate, but they have the promise of grace. And it's to be expected that they will someday profess faith in Christ. Some Presbyterians will always say are like John the Baptist, converted in their mother's womb, or like David, who praised God in his mother's womb. Others might be young children. Others might be older. The timing could vary. But there was this assumption that, and you baptize them on the basis of the doctrine of the covenant. Biblically committed to that position, but I also see the logic of it. Baptists, on the other hand, have a different logic. Their logic is this. They interpret baptism as a sign of your profession of faith. Presbyterians interpret baptism not as a sign of your profession of faith, but as a sign of God's covenant promises. But Baptists interpret baptism as a sign of God's of your profession. So by definition, then, you withhold baptism until someone professes faith. If it is a sign of your profession, you withhold it then. And there's a certain logic to that. What the Congregationalists tried to do was to hold together the doctrine of the covenant that Presbyterians held and combine it with dramatic conversion. Can you see the tension? That is where the tension came in. Because what they started discovering was a significant portion of the second, and especially when they got to the third generation, were not testifying to the dramatic conversion. So what do you do? Are they Christians or not? Personally, I think a significant portion of them were genuine Christians. And I think they could have passed muster in almost any evangelical church today, but not in Puritan churches. They had not, could not testify to 6 months of the terrors of the law, 6 months of conviction of sin, dramatic conversion experiences. And so they were not communicant members of the church. They came every Sunday. They were not members of the church. They could not, full communicant members. They could not take the Lord's Supper. The problem then comes, what do you do with their children? The halfway covenant, because membership was so difficult to understand, let me just put this here. Was an attempt to deal with this. And they came up with a practical solution. Because membership was difficult to obtain, it had important political ramifications as well as church ramifications, it was very significant. What they did was come up with a doctrine that they called the halfway covenant. In other words, if you were a second or third generation descendant of one of the original Puritan colonists, and you could testify that you believe the doctrines of the Christian faith, you did not, their favorite phrase was, you did not live a scandalous life. In other words, there was nothing in your life that would point to that. And you said, I'm willing to be here every Sunday. I believe the doctrines of the faith. Yes, I can testify I believe Jesus is my Savior. Have you had a dramatic conversion? No. Well, we're going to make you a halfway member of the church. Hence, the halfway covenant. What this did is it allowed them to have their children baptized, and both they and their children would still be under the disciplinary oversight of the church. And this was key. They did not want these people, because if they had adopted the Baptist viewpoint, then they would have basically said, go away. You're not under the oversight of our church. Can you see that? They would have said, you're not a member. You're not under any oversight. But this halfway covenant allowed them to have some sort of oversight without backing off on their dramatic conversion. This would become the dominant approach to church membership in most of New England until at least the 1720s or 1730s when the Great Awakening breaks out, when this would begin to fall apart. It would also have ramifications for what this idea of the declension. That's by that, put that on the board here, declension, this is the term, falling away. Because many of the Puritan preachers began to say, if our children are not having dramatic conversions, this must be a judgment upon us that we have fallen away. It must be our judgment on us why our children are not having the dramatic conversion. So they began to preach more sermons, saying, we've got to get our act together. It's our fault why our children are not having it. We have had the dramatic conversion, but our children have not. A whole series of pamphlets that get called the Jeremiah pamphlets start to become published. And what the Jeremiah, you can see where it comes from. It comes from the biblical book of Jeremiah, the weeping prophet who talks about the fallenness of the people of Israel. And it was a whole literature of Jeremiah pamphlets, dozens of them printed. The printing presses were rapidly keeping them hot off the press. Every minister would preach several, and then he'd get them printed. And they had them everywhere throughout New England. We have fallen. God is judging us because our children are not having their dramatic conversions. And the bottom line is the historians who have checked this out who said it probably wasn't as bad as they thought. But when you have such a high standard, it looks bad. That was the issue. Their standard was so incredibly high for church membership that when their children didn't have the same dramatic conversion, they were sure they were all unbelievers or only halfway believers. So they had this halfway covenant. Now, it would be in this context as well, as you can imagine, people of Baptist sympathies would arise, because there were some people, Baptists had become a growing movement in England, and a few Baptists started to infiltrate into New England, and it really was a problem when Henry Dunster, the president of Harvard University, announced that he had become a Baptist. That was a major shock for them as well. So some people of Baptist persuasion were coming in. And we're basically saying the problem is we've got this all wrong. You know, we should all become Baptists with our dramatic conversion and not baptize anybody. But the main body of Puritans resisted that because they said that would unfranchise from the church significant portions of the people, and they didn't want that. As I said, it was the dominant approach to solving the problem of what do you do about people who can do a basic profession of Christian faith but have no dramatic conversion in a context in which it was expected to be a church member, you had to have the dramatic conversion. Okay, so this would be one of the key things that they struggled with. Now, I want to talk as well about tonight a couple more things, and I want to talk about the Salem witch trial. Because the Salem witch trials, I don't know how much space you had. I don't think I left you very much space to put that on there, but I've got some notes up here, so hopefully you can, if you need to take some of these down, you can do this. The Salem witch trials is the thing that probably most people, if they know anything about Puritan New England, other than Nathaniel Hawthorne's scarlet letter, you know, the big A that Hester Prynne had to walk around with for committing adultery secretly with one of the ministers, they know about the Salem witch trial. And it certainly is an interesting sort of thing, and I am not an expert. I've only read a little bit about it, and there's a whole book. There's a man named, I think his name, Emerson Baker, and he's got a whole 400-page book. So if you want to read anything about it, you can get Emerson Baker's 400-page book about the Salem witch trials. He'll tell you everything you always wanted to know about the Salem witch trials. He's just one of many, but all the historians say his is the best. Salem witch trials erupted in 1692 in Salem Village. Now, what's interesting about Salem is Salem was always a bit of an odd town. When we discuss Roger Williams, you'll understand when I tell you that they tried to call Roger Williams as their pastor, and the rest of the Puritans didn't want to call him because Roger Williams was this oddball. And he was one of the guys that walked his way through every Puritan ecclesiastical type virtually he could find except for the ranters running around naked. He tried them all. But they tried to call him And the rest of the churches said, if you call that guy, we're going to disfellowship your congregation from the rest of the churches. So they were this oddball sort of congregation. The town itself had a reputation as a sort of a strange town. But what happened is that the town was, by the way, most people know it from the Arthur Miller play, The Crucible, which they're still reading in most high school junior English classes, which was Arthur Miller wrote that in the early 50s and was an anti-Senator McCarthy tract is really what it is. And so that's what it's all about. And so it's got a political agenda behind it. Witchcraft charges, by the way, were not uncommon. Roman Catholic countries were more likely to pursue them. In Hungary, for example, just a few years later, 800 people were executed between 1700 and 1750 for witchcraft. So it makes the 20 people executed in Salem look pretty small. Existence of witches and demons was not just a possibility in our theology. Most of us would probably say, yeah, I believe demons and witches can exist, but I've never met one, I don't see one, and they're probably somebody maybe sometime, but we don't think about that. These folks took them very seriously. The minister there, who was a rather weak and ineffective minister, they could never seem to get a good minister at Salem, Reverend Samuel Parris, discovered that his young daughters, were acting strangely. Now, one of the things people have even speculated on is that they think that maybe they got some bad grain, because some people have even speculated that there's strange hallucinations and things you can get from eating bad grain. There's been a whole series of pamphlets and articles written claiming this. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. But people have tried to explain, why did they start acting strangely? Bottom line is that eventually it got linked to a West Indian, African-born, West Indian-raised servant woman named Tabuta, who the girls claimed had bewitched them. And it's quite possible that she had contact with what things we today would call voodoo. It's quite possible. And it's possible that she dabbled in the occult and that the girls were dabbling in the occult, but it's hard to know. But what it is we do know is that Reverend Parris came to believe that his daughters were dabbling in the occult, and so they were brought before the authorities, because witchcraft was a civil offense as well as a church offense. The judges, this would be the key turning point, agreed to accept what they called spectral evidence. You might say, what in the world is that? It means evidence that in your dreams you saw demons appear to you as ghosts. When the judges decided to accept spectral evidence, which a number of the ministers pretty immediately jumped on this and said, wait a minute, this is a problem. It started compounding, and all sorts of people started naming people they disliked as demons because they saw a specter in their dreams that so-and-so, who I dislike, is really a witch or a warlock. You know, warlock is a male version of a witch. It went on for weeks and months, the trial, and eventually 20 people and two dogs, were executed. And the dogs were condemned as witches' familiars, and they were executed. And most of them confessed, but they were between a rock and a hard place, because if you confessed, you were hung. If you didn't confess, the execution was being crushed under piles of huge stones. One man would not confess, and he was crushed under a pile of huge stones. So if you knew that you were condemned, it was better to confess, because you at least got hung. It petered out after about 150 accusations were out there of witchcraft, including some prominent wealthy families. I think when people began seeing that certain poor people were accusing wealthy people, that this was all of a sudden becoming out of control. The lead court at the judge later publicly repented of his errors in running the court. The governor disbanded the court and demanded that no more further trials for witchcraft would be allowed in the colony. So they saw immediately that it had gotten out of control. Some of the ministers, like the Mather father and son, Increase and Cotton, wrote pamphlets arguing against it and saying, yes, we believe in witchcraft, that it's a possibility, but this is a sham. But by then, the damage had been done, and throughout history, Puritans will be associated with condemning witches in Salem Village. By the way, one last strange thing is that Benjamin Franklin's aunt and uncle were among the accusers in the trial. And because of that, he disliked this and forever would make fun of claims for witchcraft. And he would poke fun in, like in Poor Richard's Almanac and these other things, because he would make jokes about it because it was in his family. Hey, as I said, spectral evidence, I should have, and eventually 20 people were executed, and most of the leaders of the colony eventually condemned it. Now, I want to talk about one last thing tonight, and this will wrap up our rather short romp through. There's one last thing we will talk about next week about the. To do that, we need to talk about before we talk about King Philip's War. We need to talk a little bit about. We can hopefully do this in about 5 minutes. We got started a few minutes late tonight, so hopefully we will be able to do this. King Philip's War was a war, the most devastating war that they had with the Native Americans. The background to this is important to understand, and that is that the Puritans, just like the Church of England people, came with the expressed vow of bringing the Christian faith to the Native American Indians. John Eliot was a Puritan minister who translated the Bible into the Algonquian language. That was the language most of the local tribes spoke. And it was published in 1663. The first Bible published in the American colonies was not an English Bible. It was an Algonquian translation. He also wrote a catechism and some grammars. He was serious about this. Now, the other fascinating thing is I talked a little bit about the eschatology, the view of the future. Eliot, he was not typical, but he did believe this, believed that the Native Americans were lost tribes of Israel. And because almost all the Puritans believed that a conversion of the Jewish people was crucial for they were going to be grafted back in, it was going to be the springboard for the revival that would lead to the millennium before Christ came, he believed that if he did missions to the Native Americans, he would be on the vanguard of helping to bring the millennium in. So it's very interesting where you get an interesting motivation for him in his mission work. He was very serious. He gathered these Indians into what he called praying villages. And the praying villages, we'll come back and talk about the Pequot War in just a minute. I need to fill in a little bit about his converts. The number of converts that I have seen in different sources range between 1,000 to 4,000. But when you consider there's only 9,000 Puritans, that's a significant number of converts. He taught them to read and write. It's been said that about a sixth of the Indians in the Massachusetts colony professed faith in Christ under his and some others' ministry. He gathered them into these praying villages and really tried the goal. He tried to make Englishmen out of them because his whole model was if you're going to be an Indian, a convert, what you got to do is adopt the Puritan way. That means English lifestyle. Majority of the Indians sort of kept their distance, but he had over 24 congregations at one point. Some of them were short-lived, but over 20, that's a lot of congregations. Not all the tribes, though, were as friendly. The Pequots, a tribe that had muscled its way into the region from the upper Hudson Valley, fought a series of battles after committing a number of reported atrocities, and they were soundly defeated by a combined force from Massachusetts and Connecticut. And for about 30 years, it would simmer under the surface, this tension between English colonists and Native Americans. It would finally erupt in the King Philip's War, named after the leader. Obviously, he didn't call himself King Philip. That's what the Puritans called him, of the Wampanoag tribe. And he vowed he would not stand by as more English settlers kept encroaching upon his lands. And in 1675, he formed a massive coalition among many of the tribes, and launched a full-scale attack in a war that lasted over a year with a lot of destruction and a large number of casualties on both sides. 52 of the 90 towns were attacked, some of them seriously. Large numbers of casualties, and only when the English settlers mustered a large force against him did the King Philip's War sputter to a stop. Now you might be asking, what happened to the praying villages that John Eliot and all his converts? They brought them out into islands in Boston Harbor and put them in quarantine. Something probably similar to what we did to the Japanese Americans during World War II. They put them in quarantine. And they began to distrust them because they were afraid, well, what if they're just phony converts? What if they're going to take up the tomahawk and secretly sneak behind us? King Philip's War played a devastating role in the attempts at missions that looked like they started out so successfully because it led to distrust. All of Eliot's converts were under suspicion. It was combined with the fact that the colonists, especially the Puritan ministers, were already beginning to use the Jeremiah. Now, you just have to put things two and two together. The Halfway Covenant is already in motion for about 10 years. They're beginning to get seriously concerned with the declension and religious fervor. Now a major Indian war breaks out. When you are in a culture where you tend to judge all happenings as signs of God's providential dealings with you, what do you think they thought about King Philip's War? You guessed it. It was a sign of divine judgment. God was judging them for their declension. And King Philip's War is mentioned over and over again in the Jeremiah literature as a sign that God had a controversy. They would pick up the language of Isaiah. God has a lawsuit against his covenant people, namely us. And look at this. We were fine. We were making converts of the Indians. And now this judgment has come upon us. So it would mean that the successful attempts at Indian conversions slowed down to a trickle. The Halfway Covenant was still there, but they were nervous about it. The Jeremiah literature was picking up. And when we move into the 18th century, the colonies are thriving, but they're also thriving economically. And there's actually a book by a famous historian called From Puritan to Yankee. And he traces how they went from being devout Puritans to being shrewd Yankee businessmen. And it's in this period, about 1700, that we see the movement from Puritan to Yankee. And they got involved in trade. Many of them started the round robin trade with rum and New England slaves. And you might say, how'd that work? Well, you started in Boston. And you went down to the Caribbean islands, and you picked up rum, which you brought back to Boston, and then you made a trip over to Africa, and it was this triangular trade. Many of the New England, while the Southerners were the ones who used the slaves, it was the New England Yankee sea captains who were transporting most of them. That's the truth. Most of the Yankee captains were the ones doing the transporting, and they were making money. Some of them hand over fist in doing all of this, bringing rum back in molasses so they could make rum. And this was all happening, and this was just more fuel to discuss the declension. But we're going to finish with this here, and we will hopefully have time now to take a few questions here. Richard, have we stopped the? Yeah, we'll go ahead. Yeah, Clyde. They believed very strongly that it had biblical support. You know, they would look at the language of new birth and change. You once were this, now you're this. And they would heavily load these with dramatic language, the conviction of sin language, and would then want to say every Christian should experience this.
Wrestling with the law, the way that you're saying,
No. Very few thought. In other words, they did not think we should rethink this. It was part and parcel of their approach. Their approach was, well, let's come up with a new category of halfway members. Rather than rethink that, Baptists rethought it somewhat and said, we're going to have a Baptist doctrine of the church. It was a Baptist doctrine of the church was an attempt to have a pure church. But they did it with the Baptist the conversion came. Early Baptist churches, by the way, had some of the same kind of approach to dramatic conversions. They did. They expected that you would have the same dramatic conversion. They just would baptize you after you could testify. And the church had to approve that dramatic conversion.
Don't you take part in the Lord's Supper?
No. Halfway members could not take part in the Lord's Supper. No. This will become a change later on when Jonathan Edwards' grandfather, Solomon Stoddard, came up with a new theory because he got restless under this and devised a theory called the Lord's Supper is a converting ordinance. And he argued that he did. He said that if you were a halfway member, he would allow you to take the Lord's Supper because probably in the Lord taking the Lord's Supper, you will be converted. Yeah. So that would happen under Solomon Stoddard. That was Jonathan in the 1720. That came after that. Yeah. I don't know. Royce, you followed. Do you know how many casualties there were? Royce has kind of an interest in some of that.
It was a lot, but I don't know the number.
I don't either. I should have. But it was pretty devastating for the population-wise. When 52 out of the 90 villages were attacked, you can just see the numbers and why they looked upon it as divine judgment.
Burned them, too.
Burned them, yeah. Yeah, burned the villages, took captives. You know, young women would be taken off and taken off as captives among the Indian tribes, and it was a devastating war. It really brought a tremendous amount of soul searching on their part. Yeah, Jim. Oh yeah, okay, good. Time for a couple more questions yet if anybody has them. Yeah. King Philip was the name that they gave to the chief of the Wampanoag tribe. I don't know what his real name was. I don't even have it written down, but it was certainly some Indian name. You know, he wouldn't call himself king. That's what the name they gave him. Maybe they couldn't pronounce his real name. I don't know. But they gave him the name King Philip. And he had this, he was a vowed opponent of the expansion because they were spreading out. I mean, every couple of years they were starting a new village, moving in up the Connecticut River Valley, moving into prime Indian territory. And he began saying, they're taking our land. You know. Oh, by the way, one thing I could have mentioned. Before the pilgrims even landed, now maybe, I think the pilgrims were already there, but the main body, there were a couple of small attempts at trading posts. And one of them, when I read it, it was almost like it jumped out of an old West cowboy movie. There was an Englishman, as the historian I was reading, of dubious reputation, who decided he could make money by selling booze and guns to the Indians. Doesn't that sound just like it comes out of a classic? So classic, that issue of selling guns and booze to the Indians started in 1627, or whenever this guy named Thompson, I think his name was trying to sell guns and booze to the Indians. And he was quickly run out of the area, but he was trying to do that. Yeah. Go ahead, but. Thousand settlers. So when you consider that you probably have a population of 30,000, maybe something like that, 1,000 settlers, that's a sizable body of your population. Yeah. Yeah, that was a problem. You know, the big problem with the diseases is we brought smallpox, and they had no. Do you know why Europeans don't have a natural immunity to smallpox? Because we grew up around cows, and when you hang up around cows, you get an immunity to smallpox. They didn't have any cows, and they had no natural immunity, and they were particularly susceptible. Puritans brought over tons of red Devon cows. That was their favorite, and they brought them along. You know, cattle, they're little short, small red cattle, and they had lots of them. And so they had much more natural immunity to smallpox. That was a good, you know, so the, yeah, it was definitely, the Indians had no immunity to smallpox.